This morning I'd like to once again welcome Dr. Mark Richards, whose topic is kidney transplantation for the internist. Most of you here are well acquainted with Dr. Richards. He teaches at the medical school and is a member of the South Florida Kidney Disease and Hypertension Specialist Group. He did all his advanced training in internal medicine and nephrology at University of North Carolina Hospitals, UNC Kidney Center. It's with pleasure that I welcome Dr. Richards back to the podium, whose topic once again is kidney transplantation for the internist.
Hey, good morning, everybody. So thanks for waking up early and coming to Grand Rounds today. So I'll be speaking about kidney transplants today, and not necessarily going into a lot of the nitty-gritty, but just I kind of wanted to provide a nice overview of maybe just learning how the allocation system works, how patients get kidneys, and then sort of the things that might show up in an internal medicine physician's clinic if a patient with a kidney transplant shows up, namely kind of going into common medical conditions, looking into possible infections to look out for, things of that nature. So first I just wanted to start out, so the goal of the lecture, so oftentimes patients, whenever we're in the hospital or in the office and we see a patient with a kidney transplant, it can be very frustrating. You don't know what to do, you're bewildered. So hopefully at the end of this lecture, this is hot off the press, I want you to be confident and feel the need to even think you can have a very Brazilian supermodel spouse and be able to wear this amazing suit in public and not care. So I don't know if you saw that last night. That's what Tom Brady wore to the Met Gala last night. So and Twitter was a buzz. So I want you to look like Tom Brady in this suit. I want you to have that confidence when you're done with this lecture. All right. So we'll kind of talk about the transition from chronic kidney disease to end-stage renal disease. We'll talk about sort of the workup for transplant. We'll go into the United Network of Organ Sharing Registry a little bit, and then we'll go into immune suppression. We'll talk about some infectious and non-infectious complications of transplant that might show up in the office or in the hospital, and we'll talk a little bit about prognosis. So if you go into the stages of chronic kidney disease, you can see that obviously increased albuminuria can lead to increased risk of progression. At the same time, as your GFR goes down and you get closer to kidney failure, around that time, the need for renal replacement therapy becomes imminent. We always want our patients to get kidney transplants instead of going on dialysis, if at all possible. And this is important to think about because the percentage of patients with kidney dysfunction is rising. And there's about maybe, if you include, there's about 30 million people in the country currently, or maybe about 1/10 of our population has some form of kidney disease. And it turns out, if you kind of go through some older data here, you'll see that the percentage of patients who are especially over 60, who are developing chronic kidney disease is going up. And that's, I think, just as more people are living longer and developing more chronic illnesses, we have no choice but to see more patients who have chronic kidney insufficiency. So, and the prevalence of patients who need dialysis is rising. It turns out the incidence of patients going on dialysis is about the same, but as more people are living longer, there's a higher prevalence of patients who are on dialysis. And as of 8 or 9 years ago, it was about 1,700 or 1,800 per million. And then in terms of patients with end-stage renal disease, there's about 400,000 people on dialysis in this country, and about 180,000 to 200,000 patients with kidney transplants. Most of the patients obviously are on in-center hemodialysis, and as you can see, we're doing about 15 to 20,000 transplants per year. A majority of the transplants that we do in this country are from deceased donors. And what's kind of frustrating is that you can see the amount of living donor transplants are kind of dwindling a little bit, and we haven't been able to increase that. Deceased donor rates have been going up slowly. So in terms of the wait list, so since now we have more patients who are developing end-stage kidney disease and going on dialysis, and we're trying to, transplant centers are trying to do more deceased donor transplants, but obviously, if there's less living donors, patients are going to have to wait longer for their transplants. And so this shows all the different UNOS zones or organ procurement offices in the country with average wait times. And because of this backlog, that can range in some places between 2 and 3 up to 5 to 6 years, more patients are stuck on a wait list, including, people are actively listed, which are your healthier listed people. In Florida, patients tend to wait often between 3 to 5 years for their kidney off the standard deceased donor list. And so some patients have taken to extreme measures to try to get their kidneys. So this is just a quick internet search of people advertising. And so these are just random, backs of cars that were found throughout the country and sort of made local news stories. And so people are literally writing their blood type and their phone number and going from there. This nurse on the bottom, she was a nurse in Oregon who actually put out some billboards on the side of I-5 throughout Oregon. And actually 60 people came forward and she got a kidney from somebody. So the question then becomes, how do we increase the number of kidney transplants? And so currently in many states we have an opt-in policy where we have to explicitly state when we get our driver's license that we want to be an organ donor. Some other countries are experimenting with sort of the reverse, which is an opt-out policy, which is you're an organ donor unless you specify that you don't want to be one. And also there's a lot of, I'll talk about this a little later, to dispel some of the myths for potential living donors. I think people think it's, there's a lot more complications than there really are. So the lady on the previous billboard actually got her kidney from what's called a paired swap, where a donor actually came forward to try to give her a kidney, but they weren't blood type matches. But then if, let's say, there's another donor who wants to give to a fourth person, and they're a match for the first person, and the donor, so they can actually do a swap, right? Someone can give a kidney to me who doesn't know me, but then the person who wanted to give a kidney to me can give a kidney to the fourth person. Does that make sense? I don't know if I explained that very well. And some centers can even do this in chains, where if you start with one altruistic donor, I can give a kidney to patient one, and then the person who was supposed to give a kidney to that person can give one to patient two, and so on. And that's just a way to enhance the amount of living donors that we have. Especially in Boca, the patients that I see who are developing later stage kidney disease can be listed in what's called the expanded criteria donor list. These kidneys tend to not last as long as kidneys either from a living donor or off the standard criteria donor list or standard deceased donor list. These kidneys come from deceased donors who are either over 60 or the donor is over 50, plus either have a history of hypertension, elevated creatinine at the time of death, or a history of a stroke. These kidneys tend to last about 8 years versus 12 years or so off the standard list. But again, for someone who's older, who's about to go on dialysis, 8 years off dialysis can be a really, really, important thing for extending your life. At the same time, maybe, some centers tend to be a little bit more aggressive, with listing or taking kidneys from, quote unquote, marginal living donors. Some centers, including where I train in North Carolina, or most notably at Hopkins, do ABO incompatible transplants, where it takes a little bit more immune suppression, but you can actually donate a kidney across blood types. And then recently, and actually they're doing this locally at the Cleveland Clinic in Weston, they are actually taking donors who are hepatitis C positive, and transplanting them into recipients who are hepatitis C negative. And the thinking is that now with the vast improvement in ability to treat hepatitis C without significant side effects, viral loads are monitored very, very closely. And as soon as a patient develops, hepatitis C on their PCR, they're treated with a course of Harvoni or similar agents until remission is reached for a certain period of time. And there actually is some data that this could be an effective way to increase the donor pool. In Africa, actually, they've started transplanting HIV-positive donor kidneys into HIV-positive recipients to some benefit there, too. So transplant obviously has a number of benefits. And so I don't know if you're aware of this, but the dialysis or end-stage renal disease cost the United States a lot of money. We're all paying lots of money in our taxes to maintain the dialysis program in this country. And so obviously any way in which we could, you know, save money in the care for end-stage renal disease patients is paramount. And so if you look at ESR, the average patient with end-stage kidney disease, no matter what, you know, whether they have dialysis or a transplant, you know, it costs between $60,000 and $70,000 a year. And a majority of that is spent on our dialysis patients. You know, there is a trend now to try to get more patients on peritoneal dialysis, since it tends to be about 15 or 20% cheaper than in-center hemodialysis, namely owing to the reduced need for labor. But transplants are much more cost-effective. The surgery itself ends up being, you know, quite an expensive procedure, but usually after about a year and a half, the cost ends up overall becoming cheaper than if a patient had just stayed on dialysis the whole time. But obviously, this, you know, so if you get more patients transplanted and doing well, we can save, you know, us lots and lots of money. At the same time, mortality is improved in patients who get transplants. And so the red line are patients who have transplants, and the blue line are for patients who stay on dialysis. And you can see, you know, the mean survival of someone who goes on dialysis is about 4.5 years. And you can see on this graph, about 90% of transplant patients are alive at 5 years. So clearly there's a huge survival benefit towards giving patients transplants. And so obviously you might be thinking, obviously transplant patients are going to survive longer because they're the, you know, healthier dialysis patients, or the, you know, or the healthier end-stage kidney disease patients. So they actually did some studies where they took patients who were on dialysis and they separated them out, whether they were not listed for transplant or if they were actively listed for transplant. And it turns out annual mortality is actually much improved in patients who have transplants versus patients who are listed, who are still on dialysis but listed for a transplant. Theoretically, those are sort of matched because they're the healthier patients taken out. And then as soon as patients with transplants, you know, if their graft fails and they go back on dialysis, their mortality goes back up again, actually higher than previously. So more and more patients with kidney transplants are surviving. As you know, we're doing a better job at preventing rejection in patients with transplants, and patients are tend to be living longer, and so there's more of these patients are going to be around. As you can see, just thanks to some changes in immunosuppression, the graph on the left shows like how long kidneys are surviving, and it's getting better and better. We're about, you know, maybe half of all transplants are still functional after 10 years. The best type of transplant to get is a living donor transplant. Those tend to live on average about, or survive on average about 14 to 16 years. Donors off the, or kidneys off the standard deceased donor list tend to last at about 12 years. And I don't show one on here, but the expanded criteria donors tend to last about 8 years. And so we now have about 200,000 transplant patients that are walking around the country today. Just like with any aspect of kidney disease, the fastest growing sector of that are patients who are over 50. We're transplanting older people who have more comorbidities. But because, you know, we're doing a better job preventing rejection and keeping people alive, more of these people are around. And so we need your help to care for these patients in our community. So how do patients get referred for a kidney transplant? And so this is really important, especially for the nephrologist here. It's if a patient is felt to have irreversible progression and their GFR or kidney function falls below 20 milliliters a minute, they're eligible for referral for a kidney transplant. Why is that important? Because as I showed you a few slides ago, the wait list for transplants is exceedingly long, 3 to 6 years in some places. And studies have actually shown the patients that do the best with their transplant actually are patients who get their kidneys before dialysis. And so sometimes if patients, you know, they come in, they say they feel great, their kidney function is, you know, their GFR is maybe around 20, it's very easy to just kind of move them along to the next visit. But sometimes it's, you know, it might benefit the patient in the long run to have that awkward conversation about, oh, maybe might now might be a time to consider referral for a kidney transplant. And So patients obviously get very nervous about that, but if you try to explain the long-term play and maybe show them graphs like this, they'll realize that this could be hugely beneficial in the long run, and give them the best chance to live a longer and meaningful life. And this is across the board for both living donor and for deceased donor transplants. And obviously, the longer you're on dialysis before your transplant, the worse you end up doing. So the question is, who can be referred for a transplant? And really, anybody. There's only a few reasons why I wouldn't refer somebody for a transplant. Number one is an active malignancy. As I'll show you, the risk of cancer is higher in transplant patients due to the immunosuppressive therapy. Patients obviously with an active untreated infection, we don't want to increase the risk of that with these drugs. Obviously, if patients have severe irreversible extrarenal disease, namely cardiac or cardiovascular, or psychosocial issues where you'd worry about adherence to transplant medications. But again, note what's not on this list. Age is not an absolute contraindication to transplant. Miami tends to be very aggressive with listing people, and they've transplanted people in their mid-70s. Patients with HIV, hepatitis, some patients with failing livers, lungs, or hearts can also all be eligible for dual organ transplants at the right center. Type 1 diabetics are eligible for kidney pancreas transplants. So, I'll have a low threshold to refer somebody just to kind of get their foot in the door and see what happens. So in Florida, there's what are called organ procurement offices, and these are basically the zones where kidneys come from. Patients can actually be referred to multiple zones. It's sort of a way of, game the system. The catch is that if you're getting listed somewhere far away and an organ becomes available for you, you got to get to that hospital really fast. So it can kind of limit what you can do. But there's three transplant centers in our zone. The most notable one is in Miami at University of Miami Jackson. Cleveland Clinic Florida has started a program up in the last several years, and actually this is very new. I'm not even sure if they've done a transplant there yet. Is at Memorial Hospital in Hollywood. They've just started a program down there. Other centers in the country or in the state, or Florida Hospital in Orlando does transplants. USF in Tampa does them. Shands in Gainesville does them. And I believe there's smaller centers. One just may have opened in Lee County in Fort Myers. And I think there's also one at Halifax Hospital in Daytona. Those are some smaller ones. But the main places where we'll send our patients are either to Miami or to Weston, just because of the location. And so whenever we refer a patient, we'll do a pre-transplant workup, usually in conjunction with a transplant center, usually just basic labs, a drug screen, an infection screen. Usually the centers will screen for a laundry list of different, exposure to viruses or other toxins. Age-appropriate cancer screening is really, really important. Also, just blood type testing. If a patient has been transfused in the past, they might have developed antibodies, which can make finding a match harder. Based on risk factors, cardiac testing. Pretty much every patient will get an EKG, an echocardiogram, maybe even a stress test, maybe even a catheterization. At the same time, something that can hold the workup up, which seems pretty trivial, is actually dental clearance, making sure there's no occult infections or anything that could flare after a transplant is placed and immunosuppression is started. And then usually after patients are evaluated, we'll suggest that patients look for living donors. As I showed you before, living donor kidney transplants offer the best chance of long-term graft survival. And so we can't recruit donors. Donors have to step forward. And usually transplant centers have what's called a living donor coordinator, where willing donors will actually call and volunteer to donate. And usually then patients will be placed through a pretty significant evaluation. Obviously, the goal of a living donor transplant, you might think it's to get a recipient off of dialysis, but it's really to protect the donor. The last thing we want to do is hurt these benevolent people. And so that's why often there's extensive medical, psychosocial, and surgical screening that's done, to make sure that there's nothing that would be done during a surgery that could hurt the donor. Obviously, donors are selected out to be the healthiest of the healthy because we don't want anything bad to happen. Perioperative mortality is it's low, but not zero. You know, 90-day mortality for donors is about 0.03%. And they've done a lot of studies to assess how, you know, how living donors do over time. I mean, there's many patients that we see with one kidney, whether they're a donor or not. And in reality, there's really no change in mortality compared to control healthy people who did not donate. But over time, even though the absolute risk is low, there is a slightly increased relative risk of hypertension or even developing end-stage kidney disease down the line. Again, the absolute risks are very low. And in women living donors, there is an increased risk of preeclampsia if they become pregnant after giving up a kidney. So the surgery for transplants, a lot of people don't know this, but we actually, for the most part, keep the native kidneys in place. They stay. The only exception would be if someone has polycystic kidney disease and the kidneys are so big that there's no room to actually put the new kidney in. But for the most part, the diseased kidneys stay in their original spot. The surgery, the kidney's actually placed in the iliac fossa, usually on the right first and then the left if they need a second one. And the anastomoses that are created involve the renal artery in the vein and the ureter. Interestingly, for living donors, the surgery is actually tougher on the donor than it is on the recipient. And an nephrectomy can be a pretty big deal, but usually if you just, you know, sort of pop the kidney into the iliac fossa, like, the patients can recover a little bit better. Did I oversimplify that? Probably. And so I'm not going to go through all this in detail, but this is sort of like a famous picture from an old article from the New England Journal of Medicine like 10 years ago. And this just sort of shows where are the different immunosuppression medications work in the kidney. And so basically the goal of these medications is to really kind of pump the brakes on T cell activation to help limit the chances of developing rejection. And so normally when patients go to the operating room and get their transplant, they're given what's called induction immunosuppression. Usually that consists of very high doses of steroids. In some centers, that's tapered off super quickly and patients end up on nothing. In other centers, they're kept on a low dose of prednisone indefinitely. In the last 5 or 10 years, more centers have moved towards being steroid-free. The most common medications given at induction are these interleukin-2 depleting agents. You can see interleukin-2 right above where it says signal 3, right there. And so basically, interleukin-2 helps kind of recruit more, it can help recruit more APCs and kind of help with this like T cell response. And so the medicines that are initially given can have longer lasting effects because the risk of rejection is highest often in the first 3 to 6 months after a transplant. So besides steroids, often medicines are given such as the anti-CD52 monoclonal antibody, which is called which is alemtuzumab or Campath. Another type of medicine that's given is anti-rabbit thymoglobulin. Again, another interleukin-2 depleter. And then in terms of how patients are treated chronically, they're usually given a combination of two different medicines to prevent toxicity. The most common type of medicine that you'll see are called calcineurin inhibitors. Calcineurin is activated by what's called signal 1, and it leads to basically transcription of the interleukin-2 gene, which can lead to more T cell activation. The main two types of calcineurin inhibitors that you'll see are cyclosporine or tacrolimus. About, I think, 80 to 90% of patients are on tacrolimus for their rejection, to prevent rejection. And those are often combined with what's called an anti-proliferative, usually a cell cycle inhibitor. Those can be seen here. And the main medicines you'll see there are mycophenolate mofetil or Celcept. There's an enteric coated version that's a little easier on the tummy called Myfortic. Or some patients can use what's called azathioprine. You may see that used in different types of inflammatory bowel diseases, et cetera. Studies have shown, though, that the mycophenolate is a little bit better at preventing rejection, and so that's the most common type that we'll use unless a side effect or adverse event prevents us from using it. So did you memorize all that? All right, thanks. So again, calcineurin inhibitors, primarily tacrolimus, is used. They inhibit transcription of interleukin-2 and these other cytokines, so there's less T cell activation. And again, usually that's combined with an anti-proliferative, generally mycophenolate. And some patients will receive steroids as well. Again, very heavy doses right away, tapered off either to a low dose or to nothing. And those have a bunch of different mechanisms of action to help reduce inflammation and suppress the immune system. Other medications that are used are what are called, but less commonly are called, are mTOR inhibitors or mammalian target of rapamycin inhibitors. Those are over here. And basically those help prevent kind of, cell cycle activation. And finally, I'll go into a medicine called belatacept in a little bit that's new and promising, but not extensively used yet. So the big things that we worry about with these drugs and that you'll see in your offices or in the hospital is toxicity of these drugs. Unfortunately, patients can get a lot of effects from these things. The big ones are a lot of cardiovascular effects. Tacrolimus is actually nephrotoxic, and it seems sort of paradoxical that the best medicine we have to prevent rejection in a kidney transplant is nephrotoxic. But especially tacrolimus or cyclosporin, they can predispose to hypertension. Tacrolimus is notorious for causing increasing blood sugars or new onset diabetes after transplant, and also patients will have lipid problems. Cellcept or mycophenolate tends to not do those things. Its effects I'll discuss a little bit later. And the thought maybe behind a medicine like belatacept being useful is that, unlike the calcineurin inhibitors, it does not cause these problems. So as I mentioned just a second ago, cyclosporin and tacrolimus are nephrotoxic. In addition to this being a problem in our own kidney transplant patients, in our office, we'll see a lot of patients that come through with other solid organ transplants, hearts, lungs, livers, who over time and after many years of taking these medicines actually develop kidney toxicity. Some patients may even need to switch off of them to different agents or even get a kidney transplant down the line. This works by a number of different mechanisms. These medicines are vasoconstrictors. And so you can see on the left, what's called cyclosporin arteriolopathy, where you get a giant media, which then leads to obliteration of the tube of the vessel lumen. Obviously, that can cause decreased flow and scarring over time. And then, if you look closely at these are tubules over here on the right side, and you can get what's called vacuolization of tubules. It's a pathognomonic finding you'll see on a kidney transplant biopsy, and basically, these little circles there, like these are like little vacuoles that are pretty pathognomonic for this. Usually, if we see this on a kidney transplant biopsy, we'll try to taper down the level a little bit and aim for a lower goal. So something to consider is I see a lot when patients come into the hospital who have a transplant of whatever organ. I know you guys try to be proactive and help us and immediately order a tacrolimus level. Tacrolimus levels, though, have to be checked at specific times or the value is not really useful to us. So ideally, we tell our patients this too, we like to check what are called 12-hour troughs. And so tacrolimus has a pretty short half-life and is given twice a day. Usually patients take it at specific 12-hour intervals, like they'll say I take it at 8 and 8 or 9 and 9. And when we check their labs as an outpatient, they'll usually come in right before they're supposed to take their morning dose and get their labs drawn. And that 12-hour trough is how we guide titration of the drug. So sometimes I've seen patients come into the ER in the middle of the day and get a level drawn, and so those actually aren't useful because they're often 4 or 5 hour troughs, and we can't really make an adjustment of the medications based on that. And in some patients, where if we get a level back and it's high, it might cause us to unnecessarily lower the dose of the drug. So usually, if someone comes in with a transplant, my suggestion would just be to check it the next morning with labs, preferably right before they're supposed to get their morning dose. Unfortunately, we don't run tacrolimus levels here. They're sent off to Memorial Hospital in Hollywood. And so sometimes it can be a frustrating wait to get those results back. There are ways to expedite the process, but it's inconsistent and notoriously difficult. Other types of calcineurin inhibitor toxicity, big ones that we'll see are electrolyte issues. Patients can become hyperkalemic. There can be a hypoaldosterone effect that can lead to renal diminished excretion. At the same time, patients can become hypomagnesemic, and this is a big issue because both. So there's what's called like a P glycoprotein and cytochrome P450 are expressed in the intestine. And so what happens is, if you have something like diarrhea, you can actually lose magnesium. And then if you take if you end up having diarrhea at the same time, these proteins levels go down as they sort of get sloughed off of the intestinal lumen, and then tacrolimus absorption can go up, and so you can get tacrolimus toxicity just from the elevated levels. At the same time, then the treatment for low magnesium levels is magnesium pills, which can then make diarrhea even worse, and you sort of set this whole cycle into like a free-for-all, which can lead to significant diarrhea and really significant difficulty managing tacrolimus levels and function of the allograft. Patients with calcineurin inhibitor toxicity are also prone to gout, diabetes after transplant, hypertension, hyperlipidemia. The vasoconstrictive effects of these medicines can lead to thrombotic microangiopathies, or even like TTP has been rarely reported. And then kind of some unique differences between the drugs. Cyclosporin tends to make people more hirsute. Tacrolimus tends to make people less hirsute. Oftentimes, I've had patients stop cyclosporin for whatever reason due to their gums can get very swollen or hyperplastic. And also, tacrolimus can cause some neurologic toxicities, ranging from headaches to tremors, which often may not even be dependent on the level and may require cessation of the drug. And so I alluded to this earlier, but our calcineurin inhibitors are cleared by the cytochrome P450 system in the liver. And so any other drug that's metabolized via the same route could potentially be a competitor and could lead to increases or decreases in the calcineurin inhibitor levels. The big things that you'll see in the hospital are antifungals, different antibiotics, especially certain macrolides, quinolones or Bactrim. Non-hydropyridine calcium channel blockers like diltiazem are notorious for doing this too, and amiodarone as well. In some patients who, for some reason, have very active cytochrome P450 systems, and it's impossible to get a tacrolimus level up to goal, I've seen cases where we've actually given our patients, ketoconazole to actually decrease the clearance and try to raise the level up to goal. The main medicines that you might see that decrease calcineurin inhibitor levels, the big one is going to be anti-epileptic medications like Dilantin, amongst others. So whenever you're prescribing a medicine in a transplant patient, always make sure there's no interaction with the tacrolimus that might make the level go up or down. In terms of the anti-proliferatives, again, primarily we use mycophenolate here instead of azathioprine. You want to be really careful with leukopenia. And especially with MMF, you want to worry about GI symptoms, diarrhea, abdominal discomfort. Sometimes that can be aided by either switching to an enteric-coated version of the or switching over to azathioprine. And also in patients who are on azathioprine who have gout and need allopurinol, there can be a severe risk of bone marrow suppression when those drugs are combined. So you want to be really, really careful there, especially in our transplant patients who are predisposed to infections. And so then the new cool kid on the street is belatacept, which it basically works to inhibit T cell activation through a different mechanism. It's thought to be promising because it's not nephrotoxic and there's no adverse cardiovascular effects. The tricky thing with belatacept is that it's given intravenously every 2 to 4 weeks, so a patient often has to go to a transplant center to get that done. But there is data out there that shows that in patients who got belatacept versus cyclosporin, after several years, there actually was a significantly increased chance of improved allograft survival. This is a study that was in the New England Journal a couple of years ago. The problem is that it's extremely expensive, and there was also in this study shown to be an increased risk of getting Epstein-Barr virus-associated complications, namely a PTLD or post-transplant lymphoproliferative disease. So stay tuned. And so then a pop quiz. What's the most common cause of a kidney transplant failure? What's that? No, so everyone's, a lot of people are thinking it has to do with rejection. It's actually, and as of 5 years ago, it's actually someone dying with a functioning kidney transplant. It was a little of a trick question. I'm sorry about that. So we're doing a better job of taking care of these patients who I guess tend to be a little bit sicker since they're living longer and have more comorbidities, it turns out that, yeah, so more patients are dying with living transplants. And so, and part of that is because, you know, yeah, mortality has not improved much in our transplant population. So if you look at the causes of death in patients with transplants, it's the same stuff that we see in non-transplant patients. Malignancy, cardiovascular disease, infections, etc. So since so many people are with transplants are dying of cardiovascular disease, I think it's important to, you know, kind of look through, you know, the different risk factors for cardiovascular disease and see if there's anything in our transplant population that we can do to help drive this risk down. And so in terms of how to manage hypertension, there's really not great data, but it's sort of suggested we manage them like we would any of our other chronic outpatients. There's a thought that calcium channel blockers may, especially the dihydropyridine medications like amlodipine or nifedipine, may help reduce the chances of calcineurin inhibitor-induced vasoconstriction. But again, remember that the non-dihydropyridines will raise your tacrolimus or cyclosporin levels. In patients with cardiovascular disease, there's a thought beta blockers may help. And there is some thoughts also that, you know, ACE inhibitors and ARBs could be helpful as well. We don't generally like to give those right after the transplant is done. But in patients who are stable, there's a thought that there might be some survival benefit there. This was a retrospective study that showed an improvement in patients who were on ACE inhibitors over a many-year period. But again, ACE inhibitors have significant risks in these patients. They might cause a confounding rise in creatinine, and we might not know if a patient is actually, you know, if it's a medication effect or if they're having rejection or something else. If a patient has a stenosis at their anastomosis, this is their one functional kidney, and we can cause acute kidney failure that way. I don't think I've seen much in real life, but I did see on my board exam is that ACE inhibitors can actually lead to, in transplant patients, an increased risk of anemia, possibly through inhibition of erythropoietin. And also, the combination of ACE inhibitors and calcineurin inhibitors can lead to hyperkalemia. So these are all things we've got to watch out for really, really closely if we prescribe these drugs. In terms of statins, there was a trial about 10 years ago in the American Journal of Transplantation that showed that gave patients either nothing or a high dose of fluvastatin. And in these patients, LDL was lowered, and perhaps there was a slightly decreased incidence of cardiovascular issues in patients who took a statin. So in our transplant patients, we tend to use I don't use much fluvastatin, but atorvastatin or pravastatin. Certain other statins can also, the other ones can interact with calcineurin inhibitors, and you want to be really careful there. Statin adjuncts have not really been well studied, such as, you know, Zetia, the fibrates. There's really no data for fish oil, et cetera. In terms of our diabetics, about 25% of patients who get transplants are diabetic when they get transplanted. And actually, primarily because of the use of calcineurin inhibitors, 25% more patients develop diabetes or new onset diabetes after transplant, NODAT, within 3 years. Tacrolimus tends to be the big culprit here, especially if they're on concomitant steroids. And so you can see on the graph on the left, about a quarter of patients get, you know, they develop diabetes within 3 years. And then if you break that down in patients who are on tacrolimus, which is the light gray line, or who are not on tacrolimus, significantly more patients who are on the tacrolimus develop diabetes. You know, and unfortunately, if patients who develop diabetes after transplant, this leads to worse kidney transplant and patient survival. There was a higher risk of failure of the allograft, the higher risk for cardiovascular mortality, which you would expect in anyone who's diabetic, and so this presents a real problem. The thought is that tacrolimus somehow can lead to insulin resistance or the diminished secretion of insulin. And in terms of treatment of diabetes, usually patients will require insulin or some of the newer types. Lifestyle modifications are also very important. Something a lot of people will ask about is can we use metformin in kidney transplant patients? And actually, it is safe. Maybe not right off the bat, just because of the increased risk of acute kidney injury or rejection. But in long-term stable patients, patients can safely take metformin in this situation. Plus, it has the advantages of being one of the few diabetic medications that can cause weight loss and not weight gain. I'll tend to push for that, and usually, I haven't seen any problems with it. In terms of cardiovascular disease, what's kind of interesting is that transplant significantly improves cardiovascular mortality compared to our dialysis patients. But unless we're transplanting older people, we don't get patients all the way back to where they were we don't get patients all the way back to like where they would be if they were just a part of the general population. And so you can see that in our graph here. Obviously, dialysis patients have a significant mortality about 10 times, 10% per year. But then, and transplant patients are generally much better, but again, not compared to the general population. So the question is why? Are there different risk factors? In patients throughout our population, we worry about hyperlipidemia, plaques, smoking effects on blood vessels. But renal patients are kind of their own banana here. They have a lot of other risk factors for vascular disease, hyperparathyroidism, hyperphosphatemia, time on dialysis. Our patients are much more prone to left ventricular hypertrophy from chronic hypertension and volume expanded states. A lot of patients with arterial stiffness can have wide pulse pressure. There's also a thought that dialysis patients versus a traditional atherosclerotic plaque model, patients with end-stage kidney disease may have more medial vessel wall concentric calcification, which can lead to pulmonary hypertension, LVH, diastolic dysfunction, and increased arterial stiffness. And then I gave a grand rounds a few years ago about kind of looking at these same processes in dialysis patients, and it turns out in dialysis patients, statins have not really been shown to improve mortality much, whereas they have in patients with chronic kidney disease. And the thinking is, maybe because of these kind of unique risk factors that are present in the dialysis, and I guess in this case, in the transplant population. The second biggest cause of mortality in these patients with transplants is cancer. And a lot of this owes to the rejection medications that we give. The most common medications that people will, or cancers that people will get, are skin cancers, specifically non-melanoma skin cancers. About 1 in 12 patients will get one of these within 3 years. And then 1 in 12 will get some other type of cancer. And the risks of pretty much any cancer you can think of are significantly increased. And so for that reason, obviously, we want to be really aggressive with age-appropriate cancer screening, testicular self-exams, PSAs, prostate exams, colonoscopies, pap smears, and mammograms. I tend to screen our patients, or if I don't do it, the transplant center will, with ultrasounds, both of the transplant and of the native kidneys, to make sure that malignancies don't develop there. It's actually pretty fascinating, and even in how often you'll just kind of pick up a random, like, small renal mass that needs to be excised. We also recommend our patients, especially in Florida, see their dermatologist at least once or twice a year for very aggressive skin checks. Because it's, again, the risk of these non-melanoma skin cancers is very high. In terms of vaccines, pretty much you want to keep patients up to date with every vaccine that we're allowed to give. The only type that we shy away from, the live attenuated vaccines. The one that you might encounter is the shingles or the zoster vaccine. That one should be avoided. For whatever reason, if patients don't have MMRs or HPV or yellow fever, don't get those either. But again, we always want our patients to get flu shots every year, pneumonia shots every 5 years. Don't forget about your Tdap shot. And then most of our patients will have been vaccinated against hepatitis A and B when they're on dialysis. But if they haven't already done that, those can be safely given as well in this population. And then kind of real quick about post-transplant infections. So everyone always, gets giddy about, infections in this population. But it turns out that when we transplant someone, we actually reduce the risk of infection by 4 times compared to when they were on dialysis. And but again, the highest risk of infections is early on. When patients are on higher doses of immune suppression, they still have that induction immunosuppressive agent still kind of percolating in their system. And so we often recommend what's called post-transplant prophylaxis. The big things that we'll look for are, you know, we'll often give patients a course of sulfa antibiotic or Bactrim, usually for 6 months to prevent PCP. And then and I'll go into CMV prophylaxis on the next slide. But again, just remember, common things are common. The same stuff that we'll get, our transplant patients will get: pneumonias, upper respiratory infections, UTIs, cellulitis, things like that. In terms of the viral infections that to know about, the two biggest ones are CMV, or cytomegalovirus, and BK virus. So the important thing with this, if you ever are suspecting CMV or someone has an infection and they're a transplant patient, you want to know what's called their CMV status. And usually the patient can tell you, if not, hopefully the transplant center can tell you, a coordinator. And so you want to know, basically, did the patient ever have a history of CMV before their transplant? You know, usually that can be assessed just with checking an IgG level. And also you want to know, did the donor have CMV? If the patient with the highest risk of getting CMV is someone whose donor had it and the recipient did not. And so usually those patients require a long course of an antiviral agent like Valsite for several months. But those patients are at the highest risk of developing this at some point down the line. And so, especially if someone is a high-risk CMV patient, you always want to, if someone comes into the hospital with a fever or some sign of infection, you always want to make sure that you're not missing a CMV infection. A virus that only really gets play in the kidney transplant circle is BK virus. It's a virus that is very, we probably, a lot of us have had it and never known it, or maybe we got a cold from it. But for some reason, in patients with kidney transplants, it really likes to set up shop in the transplant, and it can lead to allograft dysfunction. As we've gotten more aggressive with induction immunosuppression, we've started seeing this more. And so often this is seen generally early, and the treatment for it is actually to reduce our infection as best as we can. We can actually check BK viral loads and PCRs. If that level goes up, some patients may actually warrant a transplant kidney biopsy. And the things you'll see on the biopsy, there's these little brown circles, that's the virus. That's what's called an SV or simian virus 40 stain, and that's pathognomonic for BK nephropathy. And again, the treatment here is often to reduce immune suppression as best you can. Sometimes if a patient is on like mycophenolate, you'll get rid of that entirely, even in the not that long after transplant. And then hopefully just by watching patients closely, the viral load will go down and patients will do better. There are some alternatives. Some people can get IVIG. Arava or leflunomide, which is used for rheumatoid arthritis in some cases, actually has been shown to be efficacious against this, and that can be added as well. And then real quick, there's different types of infections that can lead to malignancy. As I alluded to with Belatacept, Epstein-Barr virus can lead to what's called post-transplant lymphoproliferative disorder. It can look like a lymphoma. Sometimes you can see this without EBV. And then HHV-8, HPV, and hepatitis B and C, especially if they've had these pre-transplant, can lead to different types of malignancy as well that we need to look out for in our transplant population. So to summarize, kidney transplants are lasting longer, and so more of these patients are in the community and will need care with the help of you guys. Always know what immune suppression patients are taking and know about their side effects and potential drug interactions. And also, again, we'll need, as transplant nephrologists, community nephrologists, and community physicians, you know, we'll have to work really closely together to manage the multitude of issues that can arise in transplant patients. So that's my lecture. And here's a picture of my dogs, my two favorite children. So I kind of wanted to give a plug for something it's finally coming together after 3 months. So after what happened at Stoneman Douglas a few months ago, I felt the need to do something, you know, kind of long lasting to try to help, you know, these students and the greater Parkland community. I'm sure some of you probably live over there. I live close to there. And so it took a few months, and I've been going back and forth with some of the faculty over at Douglas. And I'm proud to say that I'm starting up a shadowing program for some of the pre-med student or future med students at Stoneman Douglas. And so next week, my first student is going to be rounding with me in the hospital. So, and I know I've talked to you before about you know, different ideas for helping, and this is the one that's sort of gotten off the ground. And so if any of you are interested in maybe like either as a, I don't know if any medical students are here, but like in either being a resident or a medical student mentor for some of these future med students, I think that their club has, you know, several dozen students, you can contact me, email me, or call me, or text me, and I'll try to set something up. So that's just something nice that, you know, we're trying to do for our friends down the road. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, I know there are some dialysis patients, and it's not really done too much these days, but in patients with really refractory hypertension who are on dialysis, we've done native nephrectomies on those patients, theoretically removing, you know, sources of renin, et cetera. But that's very rarely done these days. Yeah, so I guess I didn't really allude to it, but the main reasons that, you know, people would come off of a calcineurin inhibitor, you know, one of them, you know, could be a TMA, or at least if you were to biopsy someone and see evidence of a TMA, either you would reduce the dose or switch off altogether. Sometimes in cases of worsening allograft function, you might switch off, thinking you might lose that nephrotoxic effect. And also malignancy. If patients develop active malignancies, we'll often switch people off the calcineurin inhibitors. But that might be usually the next in line is an mTOR inhibitor like sirolimus. The thing with sirolimus that's difficult is that it can lead to issues with wound healing. It can also lead to proteinuria. It can lead to pulmonary toxicity. So none of these drugs are all smiles and sunshine, unfortunately. But yeah, but a TMA would probably be a reason, at least if not reduce the dose, to switch it off altogether. No, but there is a whole issue where patients lose. I think it might be like Medicare fund, like, you know, benefits for their transplant medications after 3 years, which seems really like it's almost like a sick joke, because, you know, after a year and a half, that's when the country, you know, we gain a benefit from the patient having their transplant, and to have them lose their coverage and end up back on dialysis would be very silly. Right. Right. I don't think I've seen anyone ever. Maybe in my fellowship, I saw one or two patients get it. But, you know, maybe over time, especially if there's more good data, then we might switch to it. The Bella is the kind of the new kid on the block right now, there's nothing else that I know of off the top of my head. All right, thank you very much. Thank you.